Welcome to the Painting Lines Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things tennis. Join Eric and Aiden in their discussion for updates on news and pop culture, and from hot takes to betting, they've got you covered.
Ready?
Welcome back to Painting Lines. Last week we discussed the top five comebacks of all time, and this week we're going to be recapping the Madrid Masters, which was overall a pretty interesting tournament in my book. Eric, do you want to start us off with any big takeaways?
Yeah, interesting's a great word. I feel like I was just shocked about the winner. Like I would have thought, you know, a couple of weeks ago, either of these guys, Rublev and Auger-Aliassime, would be in a final. I kind of wanted to see a Ruud Tsitsipas final again. I thought that we saw this nice rivalry brewing up, and I kind of wanted to be the staple of the clay court season. Obviously didn't happen. Nadal looked pretty good. That was one of my biggest takeaways. A promising look for one last Roland Garros title. And then the last takeaway was these clay courts could be so grueling on a player's body. And we had all these players drop. The balls are getting really heavy because they're soaking up the moisture in the clay. And that's kind of what affected Alcaraz and his forearm. And then you also have the fact that you can just slip and tweak something, which I feel like we saw with Medvedev in his groin or Lachko with his back.
Yeah, and I think that's just a trait of the clay and the grass, to be honest, both injury-prone kind of surfaces. But yeah, I mean, speaking on Tsitsipas and Ruud, I think it would have been cool to see them, but it also would have started kind of feeling almost like a throwback to the Big Three era where those were the only guys you saw in the final, or the Big Four where you saw Murray in the final too. And seeing the same two guys in the final is something that we've become used to, but I feel like generally is a pretty rare thing to see. And so that's why it kind of makes sense that they didn't make it 3 weeks in a row.
Yeah. It's kind of something you don't really appreciate while it's there. You just miss it when it's gone. Like right now I'm sitting here just begging for a nice rivalry that we can have, like a Sinner-Alcaraz final or Djokovic-Alcaraz. Someone that you kind of watch and you're like, wow, this is great, and you know that they're going to make it to the final.
Yeah, I think the cool thing about when you see the bigger guys make the really late stages of a tournament is you know so much about both of the guys. If you see Lehechka playing Medvedev, I know a lot about Medvedev's game. I've seen a lot of his matches. I don't really know as much about Lehechka's game, so I'm not as invested in both sides of the match. But when you know a ton about both of the guys and you're like, okay, I feel like this is what Alcaraz needs to go for, just try and beat Sinner, I think that's where you kind of get more invested in the match.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I like that take.
So let's just hop right into it with the round of 128. So first up, young guy Fonseca gets his first Masters 1000 win over Mickelson. And I think that's just a great win for him because obviously it's an important milestone if you're going to become a great player.
Yeah, this was a good match. I felt like, you know, Mickelson isn't really the best mover. We kind of saw that in the junior finals. And I just thought Zhao was moving him across the court and then getting him with the drop shot. Like he really played into the other player's weakness, which I feel like is good to do at such a young age of 17, like identifying that. I think it's smart tennis.
100%. Yeah. Great strategy is very important.
Yeah. Are we going to see these two be the future or they still got a ways to go?
They've got a ways to go. And there's other young guys that are already Alcaraz is 21. Like when you really look at the difference there, if we're talking about the future right now, I think we're still looking kind of at the guys that are already at the top, like Sinner, Runa, Alcaraz.
Yeah. They're kind of, if they keep on this trajectory, they're going to develop into younger guys that could be a thorn in the side. Like you see him in the draw, you're like, you kind of get, oh, this guy's good. He's young, you know, something to worry about.
Yeah. I think what we're looking at is it's like, what time frame are we talking about with these guys? Say 8 years down the line, maybe they'll be top 10 players. But if we're talking 3 years down the line, I don't really think that they're going to get up there that quickly.
Yeah. Well, speaking of young guys, how about Nadal and Blanche?
That was a crazy one.
That's really young guys.
Yeah, Blanche is what, 16?
16. It's Nadal's 37?
Yeah, I mean, I saw something that talked about Nadal had already won like 3 Grand Slams before Blanche was born. It's so insane to think about that generational gap. Like, Blanche obviously grew up and was like, oh my God, Nadal's like one of the best of all time, and now he's playing him. Just got to be a surreal experience. And got one game. So he can say I took a game off Nadal. That's pretty cool to say, even though obviously not the result he was hoping for.
Yeah, definitely not. I was kind of pissed at the ATP for letting this happen or deciding this first, because going in, it was just, you didn't want to see him lose to a 16-year-old. Like, that would, at the end of his career, for that to happen would just be a very big negative that people kind of fixate on. So I thought they were kind of doing it as a publicity thing, like, oh, he's, you know, 20 years older than this guy. I saw tweets kind of pissed that Blanche had a wild card into this tournament. Even though there were people that are a lot better than him, they were saying that they wanted to sell the storyline. Like, oh, this young guy, been training in Spain, young American, also a lefty, sponsored by Nike. Like, they kind of set that match up. Like, they picked him over, say he's ranked, I don't know, 1,000, and they picked him over guys that were ranked a lot better than he was.
Yeah, that's definitely true, but I assume there was a reason for it. Like, did he win? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe
he probably
the-
put himself in position for him to earn it. So, like, he got a wild card into a tournament that got him a wild card into this. You know what I mean?
Like,
something he still had
like
to
that.
Win.
Yeah, I doubt like it was that. Completely just like, hey, we're going to pick this guy out of nowhere.
Right.
So, I understand the frustration for guys that didn't get into the tournament, but I assume there was a reason for it. But, yeah, so moving on to the round of 64. Big shock here. We had two top 10 guys out already, both of the one-handers. So, Dimitrov had a pretty surprising loss to Mensik, who we've obviously talked about a few weeks ago when he beat Murray and made the final in Dubai, I want to say. I was really shocked, though, to see Tsitsipas go out, the other one-hander, because he lost in straight sets, and it didn't really seem like he was in that match. Like, 6-4, 6-4, it's not obviously a blowout, but it's not, like, no tie breaks, nothing like that.
Mm-hmm. I think this is that classic case of you have the lower ranked guy coming in, playing freely, playing more aggressive because they really have nothing to lose. And he just kind of got the early jump on Tsitsipas. Tsitsipas's confidence kind of struggled. He's probably thinking, wow, I'm losing to this, you know, I'm in the round of 64. I'm a favorite to win this tournament and I'm about to lose to this guy. I don't even know who he is. And I feel like that kind of takes a toll. Same kind of thing with Dimitrov. Like, we have a young, aggressive Jakub Mensah who is coming out there to play. You know, he's not really playing percentage tennis. He's going to win early points. And Dimitrov also probably was taken aback by it too.
100%. Yeah. How do you think Montero played?
Dude, I thought he played really well. I think he was, it felt like the tennis balls were coming off his racket like lasers. That's how fast he was hitting the ball. Felt like Tsitsipas was constantly on the defensive side. Like, he couldn't even get a point together.
Yeah, and like we saw against Rude, I think Tsitsipas tends to play better when he's on sort of the front foot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because we have guys like some, obviously, in Nadal, who can play really well off the back foot and make spectacular plays and win points, or play from neutral like you see Djokovic and Sinner. There are guys that don't always play the best when they're on the front foot, but I think Tsitsipas is one of those guys where that's sort of his strength.
Yeah, I think so too. Because you saw Montero coming, pinning him in the corner and then finishing at the net. And that's just, especially when you're supposed to be winning the match and you're kind of getting dominated like that, it's a real just like, oh, head down, palms up type of moment.
100%. But speaking of a guy that maybe would have done better playing defensively, Nadal got his revenge against Deminar. I mean, I thought this was an incredibly positive sign for where he's at right now, given the fact that obviously he lost to Deminar last week, comes back in this week and gets it done against him. Really an impressive win because Deminar is a top 15 guy right now.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I kind of counted him out before this match. I was like, oh, Deminar's going to win. So definitely going to eat my words here. That was a great match. And I thought Nadal looked great. Like, his fitness, there wasn't really anything that I could say.
100%. Another guy that wasn't looking as good was our American man, Tiafoe. Tiafoe has kind of continued to struggle. He's 1-3 in Masters 1000 so far this year. And he actually, after Madrid, he went and played in a challenger tournament, lost in the first round there too. So, not a great feeling for him, given the fact that he's a top 25 guy. You expect a lot from him. I'm sure he went into this challenger expecting to win it pretty easily and loses in the first round. So not a great spot for him.
Yeah, it's sad, man. He's in what's called the Valley of Despair. I can't take credit for that term. I've actually heard it. Kyle Matthews, commercial real estate broker. He was talking about his job and just like his career. And he said every broker goes through this where, you know, you're on top of the world closing deals and then you're at the bottom, just nothing's hitting, deals are falling through, but you bounce back eventually, you get out of the valley. I feel like that's kind of what we're seeing with Tiafoe. It's hopefully just, you know, a little blip in his great career. I think he will come back. There's nowhere to go than up, right?
I mean, like, where's you could also go straight down.
Yeah, that would be, it's got to take a lot to go straight down. He'll probably hang in the valley for a bit more and then hopefully US Open, we see him back in action.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of the argument there. It's like, really, there's three ways to go, right? He could completely fall off a cliff and
that would be an injury or like dramatic stop, right?
Yeah, he could maintain where he's at, which is something where you're like, oh, this guy, what we expected so much from him, and now he's kind of just sitting in this spot. That's, it's like Murray after he came back from injury, right? He came back from injury, and if you look at compared to normal players, he hasn't had like a bad career compared to like 90% of players since his injury. He's sat probably around the top 50, but when you compare it to what he was before the injury, it's like, obviously this is pretty disappointing. I think you could say the same thing about Tiafoe maybe, is, yeah, he may start sitting around like rank 30 or something like that. And yeah, that's not bad, but it's like, is not great compared to what we have seen from him in the past.
Yeah, and that brings us right into round 32 with the other American, Fritz beating Baez.
Yeah, honestly, I think this was a really solid win for Fritz because Baez is a high-level player on clay. I mean, I made that short a couple weeks ago or maybe last week that was talking about the rankings of guys on clay based on their points over the last 12 months and got some hate about the reactions but because people thought it was opinion, but Baez was actually the number five guy on clay courts over the last 12 months. So obviously this is a very solid win for Fritz.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think it was, it got a little spicy in the comments, huh? This is funny. So this brought Fritz to 5-0 against Baez. And I was interested because I looked at the head to head and I feel like it was one of those matchups where you have a very good player in Baez, but then Fritz just being like, all right, I own you. I'm 4-0 against you. I haven't lost against you, and I'm sure as hell not going to do it today. It's one of those statement wins. Like, there are people where you just don't lose to, even though they are good people.
Yeah, I think, honestly, to an extent, that's kind of happening in an interesting way with Sinner and Medvedev right now. Like, Medvedev was undefeated against Sinner, I think, the first six times they played or something. But then Sinner has won, like, their last six matchups after that. And especially when you look at like what happened in Miami, it really looks like Sinner completely just has Medvedev's number. Like, Medvedev looked so lost in that match. Yeah. So Sinner kind of just, yeah, like you said, just asserting dominance, being like, you used to be able to beat me. Now you have no chance.
Yes, exactly.
But moving on to a match that kind of shocked me from this round was Griekspoor beating Runa. So Runa, obviously, we know he has the ability, but I think this is another example of him showing a lot of inconsistency in his play level.
I know, man. I was super bummed because I think Runa is a great clay player, and I was expecting a lot from him this tournament, and we didn't really get it. If I was Patrick, I would be pretty nervous right now with the previous, you know, coaching changes after this. His job is definitely on the line right now.
Yeah, it was a little bit disappointing, but obviously the positive of Madrid is like you then have another Masters 1000 and a Grand Slam after that. So it's like you lose this week, bummer, right back next week.
Yeah, and with all the big pullouts too, Runa is a guy that you really can see do some damage there.
Yeah, that is definitely an opening up draw in Italy. But speaking of inconsistent guys, we had Rublev beat Davidovich Fokina in the round of 32. And I think this was just kind of the start of that momentum for this tournament because obviously had not played well recently. We talked about how he's very streaky. He gets into these deep troughs, But what's interesting is we also talked about how he's not going to lose forever, and sometimes when he comes back really strong. And so what we saw here was he wins his first round. He then beats Davidovich Rokina, who obviously is a solid opponent and is very high quality on clay. He made the Monte Carlo final in 2022, which is interestingly his only ATP Tour level final is a Masters 1000. So that's pretty interesting. But overall, I think just a good step forward for Rublev.
Yeah, definitely. That is a good win. And the match was a little contentious too. Remember, I kind of touched on it last week, but there were a few reffing mistakes. And I think Davidovich Fokina kind of got the better end of the bad calls. Also, the handshake at the end, it was made into a meme this past week because challengers came out and there was, you know, some chemistry between the two players in the movie. And then with the handshake, Davidovich Fokina got like super close to him. And it was just memed about them about to make out, like, oh, what are they going to kiss? Like, it did. It was just so funny. Like, people are so quick to just start memes, you know?
Yeah. Anything can become a meme out of nowhere. But another thing we were talking about in last week's episode was Tommy Paul's match against Cerundolo. It was going into a third set, I think, while we were recording. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately for Tommy Paul, didn't get it done, lost in three sets. But a good run for him just because he won a match and he lost to a guy that is a solid player on clay, especially coming off an injury. I think that's a positive step for him.
I think this is very positive for him. Like you said, he kind of plays the perfect amount of tennis here. He comes in, gets his first win of the tournament, doesn't win the second against Cerundolo, but Cerundolo played damn good. And I think he has a lot to walk away from positively. Like, maybe even it's the perfect amount of tennis. Obviously, he would have liked to win, but maybe this was for the better, for the ankle, to kind of get some more rest going into next week.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing a lot of injuries.
Yeah, avoiding the re-injury of the ankle.
100%. Mm-hmm. It's good warm-up. You know, like I said, he was playing really well, and I think it's a good loss because he played three hard sets. That's kind of all you can ask for a guy just coming back from injury.
Exactly. And Nadal, like the last round, I think he beat Deminar, was impressive. He beats Kachin, also impressive. And I honestly thought that after he won this match, he had a pretty decent draw ahead of him. Because I was looking at it, I was like, okay, he has Lehechka, who, in my opinion, is not as good of a clay court player as Deminar. I think what happened in that match, which we'll get into, was just Nadal probably having a little bit of fatigue and Lehechka playing above what maybe was expected from him. But then he had Medvedev or Bublik, and both of those guys, I expected Medvedev to win, and I was like, Medvedev isn't the most solid clay player. In the end, it wouldn't have mattered, to be honest, but I was like, this could be an opening up of a draw here for Nadal.
I know, Aiden, I'm not going to lie. You kind of got my hopes up when we were talking about it earlier in the week, and you're like, this could be it. Look at the draw, Nadal. You know, it could be something magical. And it got me thinking the last ride, like if he would have won his last Madrid Open, they would have turned it into a Netflix doc. It would have been the Last Dance tennis version. Like that's what I was thinking at the moment.
Yeah. Would have been cool, but
too bad. But I wonder how many tennis players make their retirement. They set it as like, okay, this is the last tournament I'm going to play in, you know, win, lose, draw, or I'm going to retire after I win this title. Cause you know, we had Sampras retire after winning a title. And then you have, I think Agassi just played his last game in a U.S. Open. Roddick played his last game in a U.S. Open. Like, just they ended their career on losses rather than wins.
Recent one, Isner.
Yeah.
I feel like that does put a crazy amount of pressure on your opponent, to be honest. Is like imagine being Michael Moe playing against Isner, and you're like, holy shit, if I beat this dude, I'm retiring him.
Yeah. Whoa, when you put it like that, that is...
Dude, I'm going to end this man's whole career.
That is complete just, yeah, I know.
Anyway, moving on. FAA, I bet on him to lose in the first round. And actually, it wasn't a bad bet. That match went to three sets. He lost the first one. It was pretty close. But won that match, moved on, won his next match. And then in this third match, he got a matchup against Mensik, who retired early in the second set. And FAA did dominate the first set, but I think to an extent you kind of have to assume that the injury was affecting Mensik in that first set too. So it's an odd situation for sure. And it started off kind of a odd series of events for FAA in this tournament.
Yeah, no, definitely. I feel like when you first see it, you're kind of like, oh, someone retires the match. And then from then on, it was just like the dominoes started falling.
Exactly, exactly. But that kind of concludes the round of 32, I think, because there were like other really close matches, but nothing really unexpected happening in those.
Right, right. I agree. So round of 16.
Yeah, so starting this off in the round of 16, we can talk about Nadal's loss. We kind of already talked about it a little bit, but I think he just was a little bit fatigued. Obviously, he hasn't played this many matches in a row in months, maybe a year that since he played this many matches in a row. And he just couldn't quite do enough to get past Lehecka.
Yeah, Lehecka's serve was on too. He was serving it flat, hard, and out wide. And I feel like he was just setting himself up for good, kind of nice and short points.
100%.
That's what you got to do against Nadal. You got to try to put him away early, right? You can't hang in a cross-court rally with him.
That's kind of the weird thing about where Nadal is in his career. Is like he's built his career off of having these super long, super heavy balls where he just sits in a rally with people. And now you're like, okay, his body's kind of breaking down and he's older. Do I want to still sit in a rally with him or do I still want to end the point early? So I think it's a little bit up in the air with that question.
Yeah, definitely. And then I don't know if you saw, but Kachin asked for one of Nadal's shirts after, kind of like a trading jersey. And then Lehecka was asked by a reporter, dude, reporters just come up with the dumbest questions. Like, oh, well, you saw Kachin do it. Were you ever thinking about it? He's like, no, I was thinking about winning the match.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I wasn't too worried about asking him. You know, he's my opponent. I wasn't like going to favor him like a star, you know. He's someone I'm going out and trying to beat.
Yeah, I mean, you know? Also like the asking for the shirt thing is a little odd to me.
Yeah, it's because it's not like a jersey. It's just a shirt. It's
yeah,
like
exactly.
A workout shirt.
Yeah. And
that would be cool if tennis players had jerseys.
I just think it's, yeah, pointless to ask.
I think he...
And it's not even like a shirt he used.
Yeah,
he just went to his
say.
Bag and got an extra shirt and gave it to him. I'm like, I can buy that same shirt on Nike. Yeah. .com
yes,
for like $40 or whatever it is,
probably 70 now.
Yeah, I'm sure inflation.
Yeah, no, I know that was pretty funny. I don't know if I want a Nadal soaked, literally soaked. You see how much he sweats.
Yeah, but
Nadal
at least then
shirt.
It's like he used it in the match. It's
like I'm never gonna wash this again.
Exactly. It's like when people get like the tattoo of when someone signs their arm or something.
Yeah, or players just throw out towels, know that, in
exactly,
the crowd.
Exactly.
I actually got an old – I went to a University of Florida, South Carolina Gamecock football game probably when I was 8 years old, and at the end of the game I was sticking my hand out in the alley where the players walk in to get high fives, and one player gave me his sweatband, and I thought it was the coolest thing ever. Still have it to this day.
Yeah, do you wash it?
But no, didn't
wash
it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Good memories.
Proving the point.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah. So moving on to another guy we just talked about, FAA. This, I think, was his really impressive match at the tournament. He upset Rude. Really surprising. Obviously, FAA hasn't played as well coming into this tournament. Has kind of been on a downturn for a year or so. And then comes into this tournament and beats Rude, who is in great form. In the round of 16, so kind of just shocking to see this, but an impressive win.
Definitely impressive. Huge confidence booster. I thought this was a great match, too, because you had amazing points being played out. Like, you saw how Rude can cover a court. Same with FAA, and the rallies were just great to watch. Even though it is disappointing for Casper Rude to lose against FAA, like FAA is still a respectable opponent based on his like previous accomplishments and who he was as a player. Like, it's not like he's just losing to a 35th ranked guy.
Yeah, no, and I think what we saw in this match was like FAA is known for being a very, very aggressive offensive player. And when he's playing against Rude, who's generally a pretty defensive player, I think.
Yeah.
The offensive player, if they play really well, they're going to win every time. Even if they both like play at a decent level, the offensive player is taking more risks. They're looking to end points more. And so they're probably going to win the match. But I think generally the defensive strategy for Rude works when FAA doesn't play spectacular like he did in this match. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, exactly. It is interesting when you're playing defense because – playing defense kind of just, it makes you rely on your opponent to make errors. Like, that's how you're going to score points. or at least if you're counterpunching. And in order for Rude's game to succeed against FAA, it relies on FAA making the mistakes that he just didn't really make in this match. He played very well, very aggressive game.
Yeah, Rude's looking for kind of unforced and forced errors and less winners. And on the other side, you have FAA looking for forced errors and winners. And so just that's like the mindset difference, it seemed like.
Yeah.
And then we also had a rematch of last year's final in this round, Struff and Alcaraz. I'll talk about this match in a little bit more depth later because it was my match of the week. But I think overall, it just showed again that I think Struff is a very solid like clay player.
Yeah, I agree. It is funny that we did see kind of a rematch of last year's final because I remember watching that match and just putting myself in Struff's shoes because you're playing Alcaraz in Spain and you had every single person in that stadium against you and you're playing in a final. Like, that's got to be tough.
Yeah, 100%. It was a good match, so I'll talk about it in a little bit more depth because it was, like I said, my match of the week. But moving on to Cerundolo gets another big win. He beat Zverev after he beat Tommy Paul. And to me, this kind of seems like a classic kind of clay court season upset where you have a very strong clay court specialist in Cerundolo and he upsets a guy that is probably a better overall player and is a solid player on clay. Obviously, Zverev has played excellent on clay in the past, but he's not a clay court specialist, I don't think you'd say. And so that's why Cerundolo had like a higher likelihood of making this upset, I think.
Yeah, I think this tournament for Cerundolo is a big kind of like outbreak for him. Like, this is his kind of time to shine. I feel like making the quarters is very impressive for him. A win over Zverev, a win over Tommy Paul, two good guys. This win for him would be a top two win because he actually beat Sinner last year in Rome, which I thought was pretty interesting. Like, and I was wanting to ask you what you think a more impressive win is, this one over Zverev right now or last year Sinner in Rome?
Yeah, no, that's a tough question because really you're looking at in Rome, what was Sinner? Sinner was a top 10 guy that was young and had crazy potential that we knew, but didn't necessarily, he hadn't really proven himself to be a top five guy yet. He hadn't won a Masters 1000 yet, I don't think. He obviously hadn't won a Grand Slam because that was this year. He didn't really take that next step up until later on in the year. And then you're comparing that to Zverev, who has a great history of being an excellent player and has performed like a top five guy this year too. When you look at from the whole career, people are going to be like, oh my God, this was his best win was obviously Sinner in 2022 last year, 2023. But if you actually look at the context, it's probably Zverev this year.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking because he was asked the question by the interviewer, like, oh, this has got to be your biggest win of your career, no? And then he was kind of like, no, well, I beat Sinner last year. So that's something that if Sinner ends up being better than Zverev down the road, like exactly what you said, they'll be like, oh, he beat Sinner.
Yeah, no, like,
but
obviously,
he beat as pre-prime Sinner.
Yeah, the way he's talking about it is like, oh, I beat Sinner last year, and that makes it seem as though it's like, he beat the current Sinner.
Yeah,
he didn't
yeah,
beat the
exactly.
current Sinner. He beat the last year Sinner, which wasn't as good of a version of Sinner. But yeah. I completely understand his answer because if he's talking about who's the biggest guy I've beaten, it's like all the guys that are going to be like, oh, I beat Nadal. Oh, I beat Murray. It's like, yeah, you didn't beat 2016 Murray.
Yeah.
You beat 2024 Murray. It's a little different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Obviously, this is a much – that was kind of a hyperbolic example given the fact that this is a one-year difference versus eight, but that's kind of the best way I think it can be explained.
Yeah, no, well said. All right, moving on to the quarters.
Yeah. So for the Americans, Fritz got the revenge for his boy Tommy Paul, beat Cerundolo. And another big win, I think, for him over another very good clay court player. And I think it kind of just proves that Fritz is that level on clay. And I think that's positive because it kind of seems like Americans, obviously we've talked about it, aren't usually as good of clay court players. But Fritz seems to be showing that he has a separation in terms of quality from the other Americans on clay.
Yeah, he really backs up his Hamburg final last week with a semifinal in Madrid. And then hopefully this is a good sign for the future tournaments like Italy and Roland Garros, that we have an American that's able to go deep into the tournaments, especially on clay.
Exactly, exactly. And then we also had Rublev upsetting Alcaraz. This, I think, was maybe one of the more shocking matches of the tournament, even though they're both highly ranked guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's different because Rublev hadn't been playing as well to this point. He had taken positive steps in this tournament, but when he beat Alcaraz, it kind of was like, oh, this guy's, he's back. And I think one thing that was big was I saw a comment he made, I think, after the match, which was, I tried not to talk to myself at all during the match. Like, he was actively trying to just say nothing, even if it was a positive or a negative, just completely be silent, keep it all in. And I think it worked out well for him.
Yeah, that is interesting. Because I feel like he's the type of player, he uses self-talk a lot, and he usually self-destructs from it. So it's good to see that his, you know, mentality where he's just kind of not going to react either way, good or bad, got him a success. But not to take anything away from him, I just don't know if this was a true upset because we had a semi-injured Alcaraz, right? I think if we would have seen a fully healthy one, I don't know if this match could have been different. You know, I'd like to think that there was. You can clearly see in the match he wasn't using his forehand a lot. He was kind of like stabbing it back and slicing it with the forehand. And I saw people on Twitter basically like up in arms, oh, forehand, or Alcaraz doesn't have a forehand, like this is crazy, blah blah blah. It's like, dude, he was injured. He has a forearm injury.
Yeah. Were they saying like overall he doesn't have a forehand?
Yeah,
they
were
kind of
complaining. They're like, oh, this is just terrible. Like Sinner goes down with a hip injury, Carlos doesn't have a forehand, and Medvedev goes out with a hip injury. Like, where are our top three players? Basically like that. They didn't attribute Alcaraz's loss to an injury. They were just kind of saying that his forehand let him down.
Yeah, I think it was probably, I mean, given the fact that he pulled out of the next tournament, you got to say
yeah.
It was probably to an extent injury. So
what if he was just trying to save face? He's like, shit, I lost against Rublev. I got to make it seem like it was an injury. I got to pull out.
That'd be crazy if that players did
ultimate
that.
Ultimate PR.
Yeah,
ultimate
just like
PR
made
team.
Their entire career based around like PR. I'm sure that happens sometimes.
Yeah, but it's like, hey, bad optics. You got to pretend like you were injured.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You're not playing this week.
Yeah.
But now I'm healed. Let's move on.
Let's move on to Thursday, where it was really, like we were talking about, with those injuries, a really just disappointing day. First up, no match for one of the quarterfinals because Sinner pulls out, doesn't play FAA. So FAA gets gifted straight from the round of 16 to the semis. And then the next match was Medvedev versus Lehecka. And Medvedev, like halfway through the first set, just was clearly struggling. And while the set did end, it was like the match was already over by the time that set had ended.
Yeah, it's always tough seeing Medvedev injured because I feel like you kind of look at him as a durable guy. Like, he's not someone that complains. He's very tough and he barely gets injured. So to see him have to do this is like eye-opening. It's like, wow, this is bad. It's not like he's kind of pushing through.
Yeah, and on the other end of the spectrum, it seems like Alcaraz kind of has a little bit of fragility to him, I guess is the right word. He's not constantly out, but he's had some injuries that have held him out a few times over the last couple of years. And I wonder how that's going to affect him as his career goes on, where we don't know whether he's going to be able to play in all four Grand Slams in a year.
Yeah, it would be pretty nuts if we saw Djokovic retire in the next couple of years and then become, if he gets on Alcaraz's team as kind of like a glorified physio, where he kind of coaches him to be more agile, stretching, breathing, all that like yoga nidra or yoga stuff that Djokovic does.
100%. I think that's actually an interesting thing to bring up because obviously that's something that's a big part of his career and it could be very helpful for other guys. And that's like, not only if you had Djokovic as your coach, not only could you have the positives of his experience, his knowledge, all of these things, you also could get the physiological aspect.
Right. Yeah, that'd be cool. I wonder if he's going to be like the hottest commodity once he retires.
Well, I think it's going to be not right after he retires because I think there's probably going to be a break there. But I wouldn't be surprised if after a couple of years, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if in a couple of years we see Federer coaching someone.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Who would you want to see him with?
Someone that needs mental control.
Yeah, Rublev.
So, yeah, Rublev, Runa.
Runa would be awesome.
Yeah, something like that. So, yeah, moving on to the semifinal and another just walkover, essentially, for FAA. Lehecka retired at 3-3 in the first set, and it really just made it like, oh, my God, what happened with FAA? Because he just got this completely open draw. He played one full match between the round of 32 and the final, which was against Rude, and he avoided playing both Sinner and Medvedev because Medvedev pulled out against Lehecka, and then Lehecka went on to play Sinner, and he pulled out. So he got this whole weird draw of guys just pulling out of the way and him just kind of swooping right into the final.
Yeah, it's almost like the Red Sea just completely parting for him and him walking right towards the final.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is when the tournament got from weird to even weirder, where I was just in shock at this point. Like, I've never seen this before.
Yeah, you're like, how the hell is FA in the final? Yeah. Oh, like six guys pulled out against him. Like, what just happened?
I know. I remember, like, I was on the subway and I was thinking about him. Oh, another retiree? I'm like, wait, that's not his second. That's the third.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Pretty insane. But, and then,
so, hey, the guy needed to catch a break. He got a break.
He did catch a break, 100%. But then the other semifinal was honestly pretty standard. Not anything special. I mean, they were both broken in their first two games. But after that, nothing really that exciting. Rublev got one more break in the first set and one break in the second and ended up beating him by two breaks. So nothing that exciting.
You pretty much summed it up. I got nothing really to say on this.
Yeah, and so with that, we find ourselves at the final. So obviously, like you said at the very beginning, these were two guys we did not expect to be here, but we saw a pretty close one. Rublev ended up winning it 4-6, 7-5, 7-5. And even going into this match, with two guys that have kind of struggled with their mindset at times, I felt like it was going to be a very momentum-based match. And with how the match started, it really seemed like FAA had a lot of opportunities here. Jumped out, got this 4-1 lead, broke Rublev twice after he double-faulted twice in the first game of the match. And he was up 4-1, 40-love. Doesn't close out that game. And Rublev then battled back from there and actually had a chance to even up the breaks at 5-4. But FAA kind of served his way out of trouble. Closed out the set, won at 6-4. But even at that point, Rublev had completely flipped the momentum. You come into this second set, and it's pretty close throughout. I mean, I saw it really seemed like both guys were serving very solidly, and Rublev seized that opportunity at 5-6, got the break, and took the set. And then in the third set, it kind of just seemed like FAA was really struggling with cramping. They were talking about that a lot, a lot on the broadcast, and that set was kind of strange to me because it felt like we were just waiting for Rublev to eventually break FAA. Every single game or changeover, it seemed like FAA comes out and serves and has a really tight game that maybe he holds on to. Okay, he holds on to it. And then Rublev comes out and wins his service game in like 5 points.
I kind of expected how the third set of tennis went. Rublev definitely struggled in the first set. Like you said, I think there's something having to do with nerves or jitters. But I'm surprised he even elected to want to serve first because he won the toss. And then he had the same issue in the semis against Taylor Fritz where he came out, served first, and didn't do a great job, lost his first service game. Never want to lose the first game of the match. It just kind of sets you off. But kind of going back to what I was saying, the third set of tennis was the best I've seen the whole match. Like, even though you had FAA kind of struggling with the cramps and you never knew if his legs were going to make it, you're like, oh, dude, he's going to give out. He's only played, what, six games? You said this whole tournament, he's got to be out of shape. But we saw him getting in even longer rallies and playing better tennis, I felt like.
Yeah, it was very entertaining to watch. And it seemed like he was just digging the last little bit out that he could. Unfortunately, obviously didn't get it done in the end. Got broken at 6-5, and Rublev took the match. So,
yeah, I mean, still good for FAA.
Yeah, it's weird.
Ranking,
because,
what, 20 spots?
Yeah, he went from, I think, 35 to 20. So, massive
okay, 15.
Jump. Yeah, but it's weird for him because it's like, okay, does this mean going into Italy, we're expecting, as a top 20 guy, we expect him, what, to have a good chance of making the top 16?
So that's a great question. I think, yeah, I think right now this is all he needed to get his confidence back and kind of be that guy that he was 2 years ago.
Yeah, so you think he wins maybe two matches at least?
Yeah, I do. Especially if his serves kind of, like, if he can rely on his serve to get him out of trouble like he was doing here.
100%. I mean, how many opportunities did Rublev have to break him that FAA held on?
Yeah, I know. Too many. I really thought when this match first started, it was going to be a breezy, just, all right, Rublev in two easily, just based on a kind of lackluster performance in FAA the last couple years or last year and a half. And we got a good match. I'm glad we got three sets, three hard fought sets.
100%. 100%.
Mm-hmm.
All righty, you ready to hop into segments?
Yeah, let's do it.
So what's new in tennis? What did you see this week?
Ooh, I got some juicy news this week. So tennis's favorite power couple is no longer together.
Wait, Federer and Mirka broke up?
No, come on. Tsitsidosa. Tsitsidosa. Yeah, so she announced it today on her Instagram story. It's kind of funny they have to announce the breakup, but seemed like an amicable one. Seemed like they both kind of are taking it in stride. It was funny. She's like, please, like, we're looking for peace and quiet. Like, don't reach out. And I'm thinking here, we're going to see a different Stefanos. So could this be why he lost early in this tournament? You know, maybe he was going through some issues with her. Finally, after this, he's like, all right, I got to cut it off. But I think we're going to see beast mode Stefanos. He's coming off a heartbreak. I'm locking in my futures bet on him right now because I think he is out for blood.
Or will we just see a really depressed Tsitsipas that loses in the first round?
I really hope not, because yeah, that's exactly what you said. There's two ways this could go, and I think he'll go in the first category.
That'd be cool to see. I mean, him take a step up. I think it would be kind of funny too, to be honest, because he'd be like, oh my god, she's been holding me back this whole time.
Well, I know, I'm sure his dad's kind of ready for her to get out of the box. I feel like his dad was thinking that she was distracting him, because when they started dating, I think that's when Stefanos' career started to decline a bit. That was when he went from like a solid top five to top 10, and then outside of the top 10.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I have nothing to say about this, really. I didn't really care when you first introduced it. You were like, oh my God, they got together.
Yeah.
And I don't really care that they broke up. Maybe that's heartless of me, but.
Yeah, I mean, there's no more Tsitsidosa content on Instagram. What are you going to look at all day?
I know. My favorite account to follow.
They deleted it. They got rid of it.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, what did you, I know you care so much about Tsitsipas's relationship, but what did you see this week in the news?
I mean, we already kind of talked about what I saw in the news, which is essentially that everyone's out of Italy. Sinner mm-hmm. pulled out, Alcaraz pulled out, Medvedev looking pretty doubtful with his injury. And it just brings up this question to me. Is Novak just the absolute clear favorite now in Italy? Obviously, he's going to be the highest ranked guy there by like four spots. Like, this is his chance to say, I haven't gone anywhere. I'm still the top guy. You still have to expect me to deliver at these tournaments, because he's been a little bit iffy on that. On the other hand, you could be like, okay, it's a chance for these clay court specialists to step up. We obviously saw Tsitsipas and Ruud doing really well the last couple weeks. Are they going to step up again in Italy with no Alcaraz, no Sinner, no Medvedev?
Yeah, I honestly think we will. I think we're going to see especially Tsitsipas and Ruud step up, but this will be interesting for Djokovic because it's a lot of pressure. It's like, okay, you are now expected to win the tournament. Anything less than that, you're going to get headlines. The GOAT is done. Djokovic's career is over. He's not as good as he was. He can't even win a tournament without the top players. He's going to get berated by the media. So there's a lot riding on this tournament for him.
Yeah, it's crazy the expectations you get when you're at the level of someone like Djokovic. Like, if you don't beat every single guy and you're not winning the biggest tournaments in the world, you've fallen off. It's like, yeah, even if he makes like the, like when he lost to Ruud in the semifinal, it was in Monte Carlo, it was like, oh my God, what a disappointment. It's like, that's not that bad, dude. He lost in the semifinal of a Masters 1000, but yeah, for him, it is.
I know, because they're saying, oh, you haven't won a title yet. He's like, yeah, but I've been making it consistently to the semis and quarters.
He's lost, like, four matches this year.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder how this is going to
15, but he's lost four matches.
Yeah, we don't exactly. It's the first part that counts. Only lost four. But I wonder how this is going to impact the tournament financially, if they're going to lose a lot of ticket sales, or if it's going to kind of carry on as normal. Like, if people are less likely to go out and watch, if it's.
Yeah, I bet you'll probably, I don't know. Cause,
like, TV viewerships, I think more so, because you're not going to get some headline matches.
Yeah, you'll probably lose out on TV. I think in terms of people going to the tournament, people will still go in those early days because the tickets are cheaper. And you'll still probably see some bigger matchups later on in those later rounds. So,
yeah,
I wouldn't be too worried about them financially.
Totally. So, bet of the week.
So, obviously, yeah, this week we didn't have a bets to really go for. We could have bet on qualifying for Italy, but since the draw isn't out yet, we couldn't make any bets on that. And there weren't really any futures bets available for Italy. We couldn't bet on who was going to win the whole tournament. So, we decided to instead look a little bit further forward to the French Open and maybe look at those lines and see who we think is going to win there. So, Eric, who'd you go for in that?
Yeah, so I kind of mentioned it above. I took Stefanos Tsitsipas as a future because they had disrespectful odds for him. It was like plus 1,400. And I don't know. I mean, I think that is a little disrespectful for Stefanos. And I think coming off the breakup, obviously this is just a very speculative bet, but I think at those odds, you might as well throw a couple dollars at that, see if it hits.
100%. Yeah, I also went for a guy that was a long shot, but also a clay court specialist, was Rude, plus 1,000.
Yeah.
And honestly, I would have rather gone, if I was going to think of who I actually think is going to win it straight up, I probably would have gone for an Alcaraz or Sinner, but they're both injured. I don't know what their health is going to be like by the French Open. Djokovic, I don't know if it's really worth the value at plus 250. Like, that's not that great of odds given the fact that he has to win seven matches.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, Rude, former finalist last year and the year before, I think obviously has a pretty solid chance of at least making it that far and possibly winning the tournament. One interesting thing that actually kind of shocked me though was the fact that Nadal came in at plus 800. So Nadal actually had better odds. The sports book considered that Nadal was more likely to win the tournament than Rude. I mean, I guess you take into account the fact that Nadal has won it so many times, but that's, to be hyperbolic, that'd be like saying, okay, Federer comes back and plays Wimbledon this year, he has a better chance of winning it than FAA. It's like, not really, because Federer is old, he's has some issues. Well, I think that's what we're looking at with Nadal here. Nadal is not the same Nadal of 2 years ago when he won it. It's a Nadal that's gone through injuries and hasn't been playing as much. So I think that's a little crazy, but maybe other people disagree.
No, I agree. I think that's just disrespectful to Rude, honestly, and Tsitsipas for that matter.
Yeah, yeah.
But all right, how about match of the week? What was yours?
Yeah, so already mentioned it. It was Alcaraz beating Struff in three. Nothing crazy about that first set. Just a standard one break for Alcaraz, gets it done. And then he actually broke early in the second, and so it kind of seemed like it was just going to go his way and be pretty standard. But then Struff broke back, forced it to a tie break. And on set point, it was actually pretty interesting because Struff hit an ace that was up the tee and it was initially called out and then he challenged it and it was in. And then he walks over and he won the set on that point. So pretty interesting that the set ended on a challenge like that. But yeah, so he had a little bit of momentum going into that third set, it seemed like. But Alcaraz broke, took a 5-2 lead in the third. And at 5-3, he served for the match and actually led 40-love, had four match points in that game, but ended up getting broken by Struff. So really a crazy comeback there. I mean, having three match points in a row for Alcaraz and the fact that he didn't convert it there, kind of crazy. And then in the tiebreak, Alcaraz went up 3-0, and then Struff came back and won the next 4 points. And it was like, oh my God, is Struff back? Is he going to win this match now? And then it flipped again, and Alcaraz ended up winning at 7-4. So very back-and-forth match, a lot of momentum swings, and overall pretty interesting.
Yeah, that does sound interesting, especially the first set you're saying how it ended on a challenge. I'm wondering, because I didn't actually catch this match, but if it was originally called out and then he challenged it, called it in, why they didn't replay the point instead of giving it to him? Was it because Alcaraz had no chance?
Yeah, it was an
Of getting
unreturnable
me,
serve. Yeah.
gotcha. Because yeah, remember we've seen that kind of Rublev get the short end of the stick when that happened too. But good to see that it was actually
Yeah.
fair.
It was pretty clear that like Alcaraz wasn't going to return the serve. And he like he got didn't get a racket on it at all. So how about you? What'd you go for this week?
So I went for kind of an entertaining match. It wasn't super tight. We had Medvedev beating Bublik 7-6, 6-4. I just love watching Bublik play because he's very entertaining when he tries to put on a show with all of his drop shots. And I thought this would be a very interesting match going in because Bublik is that disruptor type who's going to just kind of get you out of rhythm, whereas Medvedev is the epitome of someone who is just going to get into a rhythm and hit all day with you. So I was looking forward to this. And I thought that Bublik did a good job of disrupting when it came to serve because Medvedev was standing so far back on Bublik's serve because he has a big one. And Bublik was kind of just putting it in with spin, like barely kind of hitting it in there. So Medvedev was taking him pretty low, almost at his ankles. And I thought that was smart of Bublik to try to change up his serve, go fast, slow, fast, slow. Ultimately, it wasn't enough. Obviously, you know, Medvedev won. But we had the tight first set that went to a breaker. And then second set, Medvedev closed it out. So all in all, good match, fun to watch.
Yeah, I think 100% strategy is key for Bublik when he's playing someone that's pretty obviously better than him. So smart move to try to mix it up and figure out a way to throw Medvedev off his game. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot more though, huh?
Yeah.
Because Bublik is that type of player that's just going to get under your skin. Like he's going to hit with slice. He's going to drop shot you.
Six underarm serves in a row.
Yeah, exactly. You never know with this guy. He's going to get you off. All right, and that's the show. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Painting Lines Podcast. Feel free to shoot us a DM or email us any questions or thoughts at paintinglinespodcast@gmail.com.